This is your host, Silas Dean, and this is a Creep Time original podcast, The Sinister. So make sure to go check out Creep Time, the podcast, right after this show.
Well, you can't trust County.
We cover a lot of cases on here and across Creep Time, the podcast, but I would say there are very few that kind of hold on to an iconic image of terror. There's something about this story that is universally known. It is mortifying when you get into the details of what actually went down here and what we still don't know, because many of the bodies, suspected victims in this case, have never been found. It's one of those cases where the environment around it is seemingly picturesque, right? It's a very small and quaint part of Albuquerque, but this plot that was underneath it, what was going on behind the scenes in broad daylight amongst everybody, was so sinister and so diabolical. This is one of the very few cases that I will actually issue a warning, but many of you may already know the story of the Toy Box Killer. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Sinister with Silas. I'm your host, Silas Dean, and every week I come right on here, I hang out with you right after an episode of Creep Time, the podcast, and I cover the eeriest stories that I know. So please follow and subscribe to the podcast and turn on the bell notification so that you never have to miss an episode. And I would also appreciate a review and if you could share the podcast to help support the stories of The Sinister. Thanks again for stopping by. And with that, let's get into the story. So let's kind of set up the scene here. So this kind of is in the greater Albuquerque area, but it's really actually outside of it. And anybody who's actually been to New Mexico and has been to the center city area, you would know that the second that you sort of leave that central area, it tends to get very rural. There are actually so many stories out of New Mexico of like really, really sinister things going down in the rural kind of middle of nowhere parts. But this is going to take place, or start at least, in Elephant Butte. Now, the first person I really want to focus on is a woman named Kelly Garrett. This was July of 1996. She's living in this area, and she ends up having a fight with her husband. They're newlyweds. It's kind of like a lover's quarrel. It's not very serious, but she decides to leave her home. She's going to go and blow off some steam at a dive bar, as you do. So this is going to take her to a dive bar called the Blue Water Saloon. So she ended up going there with her friend Jesse Ray. Again, it's very benign. They're just going to kind of like shoot the shit, talk a little bit with each other, shoot some pool, have some drinks. It's supposed to be casual. It's supposed to be a way for her to blow off the steam. I'm from a small town, so I kind of understand this like urge to want to go out. Like that's the thing that you do, right? You go out to the local dive bar, you go and you hang with your friends, you talk shit about your boyfriend, your girlfriend. But that's just a thing that you do. It's not very... You wouldn't assume that anything dangerous is coming your way, especially in like a middle of nowhere town. Like maybe in a city, you kind of have to have a watchful eye. But when you're in like your hometown or someplace where you feel safe, your home, you're not keeping an eye out for anything nefarious going down. But that would be a fateful decision and not in the way that you think, because Kelly starts drinking and she immediately notices that something about her drink, her beer, it tastes off. And before she knows it, she's kind of feeling out of it. She's a bit woozy. It would sound like a classic case of somebody spiked that drink. Somebody drugged her. You would never, ever have guessed it's her friend Jesse. The next thing that Kelly remembered was that she kind of woke up in like a haze. A couple of hours had passed. She had no idea how she got from one place to another, but she is somehow now locked inside of a trailer. It is actually so much worse than you think. She wakes up in this dark, musty trailer, no light, barely any window. She can't see anything. She doesn't know where she is. She has a dog collar tied around her neck, which is chained to the wall, and she is completely nude and confused. But it was in this moment when she kind of comes to that she realized there is a tall, ominous man standing in the room with her. This is the Toy Box Killer. You can imagine the absolute horror when he steps just a bit closer to her and she can get a profile, just maybe a glimmer of light that shows his face. it's her friend Jesse's dad. Now, this man's name was David Parker Ray. We would later come to know him officially as the Toy Box Killer once all of this comes out. But over the next 48 hours, with her being chained up in this trailer, this man, David, and allegedly his own daughter, Jesse, they had basically tortured and repeatedly sexually assaulted this girl over and over again. 48 hours of this before allegedly taking her, drugging her, and dumping her body somewhere out in the open. So when she finally comes to, when she wakes up and she is completely disoriented, confused, but she knows exactly what happened to her and who did it, she returns back to her husband, the newlywed husband, explains what happened before she even goes to the police. He doesn't believe her. He accuses her of cheating on him. Could you imagine that? Like the long con of like saying something so egregious, so horrific. And for this man to say that you were cheating on me, he files for divorce. Files for divorce, basically throws her out of the house. She is basically shamed into silence. She leaves the state, moves up to Colorado. Nobody hears from her again. 3 years would pass. She held this to herself as a complete secret that her friend, who she thought was her good friend, and her friend's father, basically drugged and raped her. But the reason we would come to learn all of this was that it was filmed. The entire 48 hours was filmed in that trailer. Creepers, this is like scratching the surface of this entire plot because, I mean, this would really just be the first incident that we know of before this man goes on a rampage all throughout New Mexico. It extends beyond the state. But before I even like dive deep into all of that, let's just give you a bit of backstory about David. We have to understand what is the origin story of this person. How does a man like this come to be? Now, the origin story on David Parker Ray that I could dig up was that he grew up alongside his sister Peggy. They lived with their grandfather at the time. They referred to him as Old Man Ray. Old Man Ray was not a kind man, especially not to these children. He was very, very traditional, very disciplined, and very abusive. He would repeatedly beat both of these children, and they would work his farmland, basically until they could barely move. And from what I could read about this, it sounds like the biological father of both of them would come to visit, but very infrequently. And when he did, it was really just insult to injury because David and his sister Peggy, they have this abusive relationship going on with the grandfather. When the father comes to visit, it's sort of sexually abusive as well because he provides David, who's very young at the time, sadosexual masochistic porn. It sparked something in him, I think, in conjunction with the abuse that he was experiencing as a child, where he started to get a sort of an unhealthy fixation on these fantasies. He started to draw pictures of what he wanted to do to women. He kept this a secret from pretty much everybody, but eventually his sister did find it. But even then, he felt no remorse, no shame. It almost emboldened him. But I think this is important groundwork to kind of lay the foundation to see where does it start, where does it go? Because this is all in the 50s, eventually when he reaches adulthood. By the 60s, he becomes a mechanic in the army. He is honorably discharged. And then I think he goes through two different marriages and divorces. He has two wives, which he leaves behind. He finds a third, who is an 18-year-old girl. They get married. She would give him his only daughter, Jesse. This is where some of the history becomes a little ambiguous here. We don't exactly know what exactly the relationship was between David and Jesse throughout her childhood. We can assume it was absolutely abusive and it was absolutely sexually abusive. However, we don't actually have a full account of what was going on behind the scenes. We don't know what was going on behind closed doors. We don't even actually know how many people were victims to him and Jesse, mostly to him, but Jesse was certainly roped into the scheme. All we could ever really go off of were the victim testimonies of the people who sort of escaped this or survived it, but it is highly suspected there are so many more than what we actually know. So to go through what we do know, I'm actually going to track forward to one of his last known victims, Cynthia Vigil. This is going to take us to March of 1999. Cynthia was 22 years old at the time, and she was working as a sex worker, working the streets in Albuquerque. So she had a run-in with David, which seemed pretty normal. I mean, he pulled up in an RV. He offered her cash. He wanted a date in his car. It was nothing out of the ordinary. She got into the RV and immediately he flashed a fake badge. She didn't know it was fake at the time, but he's saying, "I'm an officer. You're under arrest." You know, at first, I mean, she believed it because who would fake that? Why would they fake that unless there was something really bad going down here? But then she got very weary because he said something in the middle of his like speech to her where he called her by her actual name. And she was weary about how he knew her name. But before she could even think twice about it, somebody came up from behind her, struck her in the back with a cattle prod, tased her, clamped a collar on her neck, and duct tape on her mouth. She was being abducted. Immediately when I heard that, I thought the daughter. I was like, oh my God, it's Jessie. She's the accomplice. It's not. It's another woman. Her name was Cindy. He had met this woman in a completely different state, and this was like 2 years prior, 1997. When they met, they bonded over this mutual sexual fantasy of abducting, torturing, and assaulting other women. It's like, it always baffles me, the idea that evil finds evil somehow. They link. And this is not in the age of the internet or anything. Like, this is like the 90s. But somehow, this woman, even outside of, you know, his daughter, who he had corrupted into this scheme, he found another outside party who could be an accomplice to this. What immediately happens next year is so horrific to conceive of. Basically, David had gotten a semi-truck. He had spent close to six figures, like over $100,000, I think, renovating the inside of it. Why? He was making it soundproof and escape-proof and was decking the entire thing out to basically be a torture pad. It was a place that was equipped with sadosexual, masochistic equipment. It was torture equipment. So this 22-year-old, this sex worker, she wakes up, basically, wakes up from the tasing, from the abduction. She is chained up inside of the semi. Doesn't matter if she screams. It's completely soundproof. It's stationed behind his trailer. He wants her to scream, in fact. And the first thing she hears is David speaking, but it is a pre-recorded tape. What he liked to do is he would abduct these girls, he would chain them up, and then it was almost the way I could imagine it, and this is trivial, but it was kind of like when you wake up like in Saw, and there's a video playing with instructions about what is going to happen next. That is exactly what he was doing. He was explaining, "You are now my sex slave. We will torture you. We will humiliate you. We will beat you, harm you, cut you. We will do all of these things to you. You're just being fed this information while you're chained in an unknown place, and you're basically preparing to die. You're going to assume that you're going to die." Many women before her certainly did. What the next phase of this looks like is just days on end of David and his accomplice inside this semi, this trailer, really just torturing this 22-year-old. I mean, they would string her up from the ceiling. They would whip her. They would beat her. They would punch her, threaten her with guns. They would make her have sex with animals. I mean, it was horrific sexual torture that was going on. But her story is not going to end in death. So Cynthia, she's 3 days in. And what was interesting about this setup was that David still had to work. So he was working as a maintenance man at the time in Elephant Brood. So him and his accomplice, Cindy, they would kind of take these shifts, basically, of watching over the captured. So he was at work while Cindy was supposed to watch over her. Cindy stepped away. This is the woman who's watching the girl who's being tortured. And she was on the phone. While she was on the phone, Cynthia, again, 3 days into torture, she had been tortured with an ice pick, stabbed. She had been starved, dehydrated. She's nearly at the brink of death. She saw a chance. There were a set of keys that were left on a table that were just within reach, that if she got over there, if she stretched as far as she could and she could get those keys, she could unlock herself from her restraints, which she does. While in the midst of doing that, Cindy comes back in from the phone call, catches her, and whacks her over the head with a lamp. But this did not knock her out. It actually knocked the ice pick that they had been using to torture her onto the floor. Cynthia grabs the ice pick, jabs it into Cindy's throat. When I heard, I was like, it was playing out like a movie in my mind. I was like, yes. So jabs it in her throat, gets out of the semi. She's completely nude, covered in blood. She still has the chains like latched onto her ankles and her neck and everything. Like, she's running with chains. And don't forget, this is in the middle of nowhere. It's in rural New Mexico. She's running through the desert with these chains. And I think a motorist saw her. They were terrified. But eventually she gets her way to a mobile home in the distance, barges through the door. And these there are people sitting there in their living room. Could you imagine sitting in your living room and this nude woman covered in blood and chains comes screaming, running through your front door? She came into their house and hid under the table. They immediately called 911, of course, because it spelled a story of this is a woman who just escaped. Police finally came and it was finally going to be over. He was going to be caught. Now, at this point, David, I don't even think knows about this because don't forget, he's at work as the maintenance man. Cindy had been jabbed in the neck with the ice pick. Cynthia, when she first got loose and before she got hit over the head with the lamp, she actually got hold of a phone. So she first tried to call 911, but it got cut off by Cindy. But 911 felt something was off about that call. Even though they didn't hear much, they still decided to dispatch an officer. So even before she ran into this mobile home and they called 911, dispatch already sent over officers. So when they're there, David finally arrives. Cindy is, I mean, she's been struck in the neck, but she's still, you know, with it. They tried to cover this up and say, no, she's a heroin addict. We found her on the street. We were trying to help her, help detox her. This was all before officers stumbled upon the semi, otherwise known as the toy box, because in there was all of the equipment they were using for sexual torture against this woman, in addition to the fake badge, in addition to the tapes that were used, the tapes that were played when Cynthia woke up and was first told, you're going to be tortured to death for as long as we please. This was it. But I have to communicate to you just how vast this setup was inside of the semi. I don't think people have a clear visual of just how intricate all of this was. He had basically fashioned mirrors on top of the ceiling specifically so that his victims, when they're looking up at the ceiling, could see exactly what was being done to them. The walls were essentially littered with drawings, with diagrams, all of these instructions, visual instructions of what he would do to these women. He would sexually assault them, plans to dissect their bodies, play with their organs after. There were cattle prods. There were electrical shock devices, all of these sexual instruments, medical grade instruments. But what he was most proud of, what he was most fixated on, was this old dentist chair. That was where the victim was usually chained. He had refashioned it to basically be something like a stirrup is what I could describe it as, something you would see in like a gynecologist's office. This was where the victim would basically live 24/7 for as long as they kept them alive during this period of torture. As you can imagine, the media coverage on this was insane. It's a ridiculously horrific story. It's middle of nowhere, New Mexico, which actually is a town, by the way. Middle of nowhere, New Mexico. There is a torturous sex dungeon just seemingly sitting right in someone's backyard behind a mobile home. And now we have this huge story about this woman who's escaped from it. It would prompt other women to come forward. One of which I was reading about was Angelica Montano. She was a young woman, and she actually was pretty well acquainted with both David and Cindy at the time. They were kind of neighbors. She went over there asking for something like cake mix, but suddenly a knife and a gun were pulled on her. And to her recollection, because she was heavily drugged through this period, it was 4 days in the toy box, 4 days of continuous sexual torture before they had basically bundled up her body. She's still barely conscious from the drug use. They dropped her in the middle of the desert. And of all people to find her, it was a cop, county police. It was a police officer who found her. She explained her story. Apparently, nobody ever followed up. I find that very difficult to believe. I have to assume that there are pieces of that story that I'm missing where they just didn't believe her. They thought she was a drug addict. That sounds insane to me, that they would find her in that state and hear this tale, and they wouldn't even go do a check. They wouldn't even go to see if the toy box or the dungeon was real. But again, her memory on this was kind of fuzzy because she was drugged. So she was basically not believed. She was shamed into silence, where she remained until this story broke. That was when she came forward. And then we get another confession coming forward. Kelly Garrett, the first woman that we talked about, the one who wasn't believed. Her husband thought that she was out there cheating on him and that she was using drugs. She's up in Colorado at this point, also shamed into silence. She also comes forward. We got three different women who can corroborate the story of what's going on here. And to finally back up her claims, as I mentioned much, much earlier in the story, her torture was taped over a period of 48 hours. Where was that tape? Discovered right inside the toy box. Tangible evidence to finally back up her story that it was completely credible all along, which it's like, yeah, of course. But now that we've got an actual case here, that we've got an actual investigation, that's when people start getting their feet held to the fire and people start to talk, one of them being the accomplice, Cindy. She gives way to some very damning information, saying that not only was she the accomplice, and of course, Jesse, the daughter, who was 31 at this point, I think, but she claims there are many other accomplices, one of which was a 27-year-old man. So this would focus our attention to Dennis Roy Yancey. As the story goes, he was actually a friend of Jesse's at the time, which was how he initially got roped into the scheme of abducting and torturing these women. He claims that at a certain point, he was fearful for his life, that if he did not listen to what David told him to do, he would be the next victim in some way. So he was an accomplice. He helped to capture other women and allegedly snuffed them out. He killed them and then was instructed by David to go dispose of these bodies, but these bodies were never found. That's the craziest part. I was talking about this in the beginning of the story. A lot of these cases, a lot of these women that had allegedly gone missing at the hands of this man, of this scheme, they've never been located. The next phase of how this story kind of wraps up is really the most frustrating for me because it's such an egregious miscarriage of justice. Basically, if I could sum it all up for you. So David is going to go to trial, right? And it sounds like Cindy, the woman who was jabbed in the neck with the ice pick, didn't mean to laugh. I did. But she was going to testify against him. So he's already got something going against him in his case. And we've got these three star witnesses, but all of their cases are going to be tried separately, which is not beneficial for the overall swing of the prosecution. So basically what happens is that we've got a judge. I don't know if he was corrupt. I don't know if his judgment was clouded, but he was not willing to accept certain evidence into the case, especially for some of the earlier cases like Kelly. Like, he wasn't going to weigh any of the sexual torture devices, allow those to be submitted for evidence, any of the diagrams or explanations about what he was going to do to these women, because he was arguing, well, how do we know that this was connected to her specific case and that that was relevant to when she was abducted? Which, it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. But on top of that, David suffers a heart attack. He survives it, upsettingly. But that would set back the trial a little bit. I think there were two jurors that resulted in a mistrial because they believed he was innocent and there was actually no proof to suggest that any of this was a real abduction, a kidnapping and torture, that maybe this was consensual bondage play. I swear to God, I don't know who found these jurors. I don't know what, but I mean, that was like a huge leg for the defense, for David's lawyers, because they were going to use that as their biggest stepping stone to basically perpetuate that David was innocent, that he had given disclaimers in these videos. These women had consented to all of it. It was rough play, none of which was true. On top of all of that, after there was a mistrial, they tried to try the trial again. They tried to try David. The judge, I believe, died several days into that trial, which would like set the whole thing back yet again. But eventually, the second time around, David is tried and he would be sentenced because there is a smoking gun in the mix. The daughter, Jessie. David would switch his plea from innocent to guilty in order to get Jessie off with less time. So David is eventually sentenced to something like 224 years in his sentence. Jessie is sentenced to something like 2 to 3, I think 2 years in prison for being the accomplice to what she did. So she's eventually a free woman. I mean, as of today, she's a free woman, as is Cindy, the woman who was jabbed in the neck by the ice pick, the other accomplice, as is Roy. I think he was the last one who was sentenced and was in prison up until 2021. So he was really the last person in the mix before he would get to walk free. David doesn't even serve much of his own sentence because he would have another heart attack by 2002 and is found dead. So I can't quite say it's a case that saw all around justice, because we still don't know how many other victims there were. And of course, nobody's going to talk now because any of the accomplices that we know of are walking free. They don't want to be implicated in anything else, and David is dead. I'm satisfied and happy that the story of the toy box killer came to light, that all of these stories of these women who were victims of this are believed, even though that wasn't the case in the first time around in court. But it still doesn't feel satisfying to see how it all played out in the end, to see that David really didn't serve any time. It seems like nobody here served any substantial amount of time for what they did to these women. I think it's a story, as horrific as it is, that is important to tell over and over again, mostly because of the end of it, because of that miscarriage of justice, because these were women who were at first not believed by anybody in their life, even those suspected to be closest to them, husbands, family, or protectors, cops, protectors in the community. But in addition to that, the eventual sentencing was not fit for the weight of the crime. That is the takeaway here. So I want to thank you guys for listening through. I know this was a heavy case. I'm satisfied I didn't do it on Creep Time, the podcast with Stu. We do that every Friday, but this would be one that would absolutely wreck her. So we'll keep this on the sinister between us, guys. Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to say goodbye and good luck to all of you, and I'm going to catch you on the next one.